met Jerry a few years back, and how I met him was he came up and wanted to do some service work. And it's not usual that somebody just begs to do some service work, but he knew the importance of it. I know his sponsor very well, and he stressed the importance of service. And that's been his story. He joined our Sunday night 7 o'clock group. Been immense help in developing that group. When we got that group, there was one time we only get a dozen people in that group. Now it looks about like this. And been a big, big help. Since then, he's also become the GSR of that group. That group's never had a GSR. I don't think they know how to say GSR in that group. Jerry's a GSR, goes to Macon. And it's just been a heck of a ride getting to know Jerry, and he works a great program, works with a lot of sponsees, does a lot of help for a lot of young people. So with that, I'll give Jerry.
Woo, a lot of y'all. Y'all nervous? My name is Jerry Fair, and I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Jerry.
And by the grace of God, I've not found it necessary to put a drink or a drug in my system since July 6th of 2017, and for that, I'm extremely grateful. All right, so I usually start off with reading something and end something with reading something, but one thing I never do is I don't plan. The first time I spoke, I planned it all out. I wrote it down on paper. And it was the worst hour and 45 minutes anybody had ever heard. And guess what? I never got sober in the entire talk. An hour and 45 minutes. I'm going to try not to do that tonight. I am going to go into the big book probably quite a bit, because that's where the solution's at, is in this book. Where to start? I grew up in a small town outside Macon, Georgia, which is about 2 hours south of here. I had a mixed bag childhood. Was there some trauma? Were there some hard times? Were there some financial difficulties? Of course. But where I grew up, everybody had that. Nothing extreme, nothing to look back on and say, this is the reason why I started to drink. Now, knowing what I know about this program and about who I am, it's really easy to look back and see why I drank. Far back as I can remember, I have been selfish, self-centered to the core. And I've been driven by my delusional self-image of who I was and a fear. As far back. I have 4 older brothers. They're quite a deal older than me. Anywhere from 10 to 7 years older. They all were successful in their own right. Amazing athletes, scholars, musicians. And I remember the attention that they got and wanting that attention and validation. And I remember never living up to it, to what the ideas I put on myself. I was not a good baseball player. I wasn't as good at riding a skateboard. I couldn't play a guitar as well. One of my brothers was a ladies' man, didn't get the girl. I felt like I did not belong, far back as I can remember. Then when I was 12 years old, I discovered alcohol. And I discovered a peace and a sense of ease and comfort that I'd never felt before. And I tried to drink it as often as I could. I tried to do anything that would change the way I felt about myself, so I wouldn't have to come to terms with who I really was inside. I had no interest in finding out who I really was. I just wanted to be as good as you all, or at least the way that I seen you. I've always compared my insides, who I was internally, with the way everyone else looked. And I always failed. I never lived up to what I thought I should be. By the time I was 15, 16 years old, drinking had become a part of my weekly life. 3 or 4 times a week. By the time I got out of high school and started college, it became damn near an everyday thing. I had managed to be successful at work. I managed to make money. Made a good bit of money. My dad turned over his company to me when I was 21 years old. My drinking was really out of control by this point. Every weekend I was drunk. Three nights out of the week I was drunk. But I'm 21 years old. I made over 200 grand this year. My life's not unmanageable. Don't tell me my life's unmanageable. Never mind that my family was afraid. My first of several wives was scared every night. But my life wasn't unmanageable. I had this. When I was 27 years old, I got hospitalized for the first time due to alcohol. I got put in ICU. I spent a week in there. At 27, they put me on blood thinner so I couldn't drink. I went 10 months without alcohol. And it was the most miserable 10 months of my existence. I was pissed off at the people who could drink and drank because I couldn't. And I was really pissed off at the people who couldn't didn't. There is a nectar of the gods out there and you're not taking advantage of it. I was on this blood thinner so I couldn't drink. One day I got in the shower, started bleeding everywhere, called the doctor, said, oh, it's time to take you off the blood thinner. Just take aspirin every day. It took less than 24 hours for that light bulb to go off in my head. I can drink again. First night I was a little gun shy because I didn't want my heart to go out of rhythm again. I had a drink. The next night I had three drinks. By the end of that week, there's no point in counting. But I know I was messed up as a New York City yard rake within 3 or 4 days. And it didn't stop. I gave away the first wife, the second wife, the third wife, two children that had been put in my life that I loved with all my heart. Gave them away. Gave away contracts, money. Stole from my parents. Stole my mother's Social Security check. Stole my dad's medication so I could get intoxicated around the clock. From the time I was 27 to the time I was 39, I managed to put together 3 days sober, and they were not consecutive. Alcohol defined every ounce of my existence, who I was, my being. I used to say that I loved it more than anything on this planet. But I like to compare it to a spouse that you have that is abusive. That's not love. When someone slaps you in the face or pushes you up against the wall and says, I do this because I love you, that's not love, that's obsession. And that's exactly what I was. To the core, alcohol was my master. I left a trail of misery, despair, and I felt just incomprehensible demoralization from don't know, countless states. From here to South Carolina, to Florida, to Texas, I disappointed people, let people down, caused pain, sorrow, grief, and I drank myself to the point when I was 39 years old that I was in the hospital bleeding internally, and my blood pressure was 190 over 110, and I'd lost any chance of hope. I was a rolling damn dumpster fire. I couldn't make a living. I was a prey to misery and depression. I had problems with personal relationships. I couldn't be of help to other people. Have I qualified myself? Good, let's move on from that shit. Okay, so might have to talk about it a little. I might bounce back and forth, but I don't want to spend a lot of time in that because there's no solution in that. And when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew how to get drunk thoroughly. I had a PhD in it. The one thing I didn't know anything about was getting sober. That I had to learn from you people. And this book that I love so much, that I thump on every occasion I get to thump it, because that's where the precise method of recovery is located. So on July 5th, I woke up in a motel, shaking all over. I couldn't drink enough. There was not enough alcohol in the world to calm my nerves or settle my organs inside. I drank one after another, after another, after another. And I caught myself standing outside. And I'd like to say I threw my hands up in there and said, God, what now? But I didn't even have the energy to do either one of those things. I want to make it real clear that I was not desperate at this point. I was not clinging to something to help me. I was utterly hopeless. There was no hope. People had begged me to go to detox, go to the hospital. I said, you know what? Honestly, looking back, this is how I felt. It didn't matter. Yes, I'll go to shut you up. I'll be dead before the day is over. But I didn't die. I made it out of that emergency room bed, and I made it into that detox wing. And I woke up July 6, 2017, in a detox. And anybody that says that they didn't experience the luxury of a cushiony detox, I'm going to tell you, yes, I had meds and I had things like that, but that was a hell that I would wish on nobody. I spent a week there. And while I was there, I like to say I got a little slither of hope while I was there. This really nice lady said, why don't you go to treatment? I want us to call it hope, but really what I want to call is back to this selfishness and fear, because I wasn't sure that if I left the hospital, if I had anywhere to go home to. That's how disgusted my wife at the time was with me. There's a place called Blue Ridge Mountain Recovery Center in North Georgia. Good thing about it is it's a 35-day program instead of the 28-day program. It's really nice. It's got a lovely view. The weather's nice. You got basketball courts. See where I'm going with this? Damn, I don't have a place to live for sure, but I can go on a 35-day vacation. And that's how I viewed it. So I went on this 35-day vacation. And from the time I got there, the first week or so, they hit me with this big book, this blue book that said Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd never read. I'd never been to a meeting, never read this book, knew nothing about recovery. What my idea of Alcoholics Anonymous was, a bunch of old bitter people sitting around talking about how miserable life was, but at least they're sober today. I had no interest in that. Still don't. Yeah. Well, we didn't drink today. That's a win. Mm-hmm. Or, It's tough, but it's okay. Now, you can say that some people look at it and say I had a high bottom or a low bottom. I look at it as a low bottom because I have this much threshold for pain. I am not going to suffer or be miserable. I am not, pure point blank. I'm not. Thank God that's not what y'all had in store for me. So they hit me with this book. They talked to me, hit me with some treatment stuff, and you got to do this, you got to do that. I don't know, somewhere between 5 to 10 days in there, I'm back to, I got about 30 days or whatever left in my vacation, and then what? I'm going to be back into the world. How many days can I drink before I actually die? At this point, I am not happy about my sobriety. I can absolutely not imagine drinking. I can't imagine life drinking or not drinking. And one day, they haul us up, tell us time for group again. I go up them stairs in this blue room and just group again, where they read how it works and the traditions again. And said, today we're going to have a speaker. And this man sat down. And I don't know what happened, but from about the moment he opened his mouth till the end of that hour, I couldn't take my eyes off of him. Something happened. He spoke my language for the first time in my life. I've had doctors tell me. I've had judges tell me. I've had family beg and plead with me to stop. I didn't care. Didn't care. There was no physical consequence. There was no financial consequence. There was no bottom low enough for me. There is no bottom. I don't care about these things. I have no choice. I am an alcoholic. I am going to drink. That is what I do. Damn the consequences. This man had the same, pretty much same story. And he said that he read this book that they gave him when he got to treatment. And that somebody shared with him one day. Face to face, I believe, is what he said. I was in a group. He was talking to 50 people. But I felt like he was talking exactly to me. It was quite clear. I don't remember word for word what he said, but it was clear by the time he got done that he was exactly like me, and now he was not. That he had a solution. That this man was happy. Most of the time, he was joyous. That he was damn sure free. Happiness, joy, whatever. You know, it comes and goes. We experience pain in this life. He made that clear. The free part, because I hadn't felt free for a long time. A long, long time. And had two thoughts go through my mind. The first one, honestly, sincerely, was I believed him. And that was my bottom, that I was not going to have what he has. I've always been afraid I'm going to miss something. Like when I was a kid, I was scared I wouldn't get a toy. When I was a teenager, I would miss the party. I would miss this event, miss this concert. It's a character defect of mine. I believe God used it in that moment. I'm going to miss out on what this man has. So, it was either that I believed him, I was going to do this thing, and it was going to work, or I was going to do it exactly like y'all said and get on national TV and said, y'all are full of it, this does not work, it's a fraud. Either way, I win. Because either way, I didn't know what this meant at the time, but either I recover and I'm happy, joyous, and free, or I get to expose the shortcomings of others. Something that I used to really enjoy doing. So, he described his life, what he was like, and what he was like in his recovery. Come to find out, I've listened to a few speaker tapes, and I think he got this from Mark Houston, but I've heard very little since I've been here that's original. But either way, it's good stuff. He said, when I was in my addiction, when I was out there in the streets, when I was hustling, I was a mad dog. I don't do anything halfway. It occurred to me that if this thing was going to work, I had to approach it like a mad dog. Half measures availed me nothing at the time. I didn't know what he was talking about. I do remember that. Half measures availed me nothing. There is no middle of the road solution for me. I'm going to do this or I'm not. Damn, that sang true to me too. So I picked this book up right then. I went to my room and I opened it up and I started reading it. And I had several weeks to read this book. And damn, I opened it up and I'm reading in this doctor's opinion when they're explaining this allergy that I have. That when I put alcohol in my body, I don't react the way normal people react. That when y'all have a couple and y'all do that, oh, I'm starting to feel it thing, I don't do that. I say, give me more. The physical aspect of this thing was so important, I never understood. And more importantly, I never understood the reason why I picked up the damn first one to begin with. That I am driven by this obsession of the mind. That I am going to do something that is going to provide me a sense of ease and comfort. And if I don't have a solution, the solution I have today, what's it going to be? Alcohol. I love alcohol. That's the way I felt. I love you, alcohol. You are my girlfriend. You are my true love. Hold me tight. Squeeze me. Rub my damn back. Every night was what I wanted from alcohol. There's a little bit of outside issues in here, but really it was alcohol was my thing, man. There was no amount of desire. There's no amount of desire on the planet for me to stop on my own willpower. I couldn't do it. The doctor's opinion helped explain that to me. And it says something about having to have a psychic change, a total different way of living, thinking, seeing the world around me, to summarize. I can't quote it verbatim, but I'm kind of a, I want to, so. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. Maybe some of y'all can relate to that. This is repeated over and over, and as I like to say, over and over and over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. The way that the spiritual experience defines a psychic change as a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism, or a profound alteration in his reaction to life, not to alcohol. I was starting to understand, and then as I read Bill's story, that was like reading my life story, except it's not the 1930s. And then more about, I got into There's a Solution and more about alcoholism and these things in this book. And I felt so dumb. It's like, where was this information 15 years ago? Probably wouldn't have heard it anyway. Probably wouldn't have read it, because I'm hard-headed. But this entire psychic change, a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism and a profound alteration to his reaction to life. I don't see anything about just make sure I don't drink right there. That which they stress on page 25 and 27 in this book. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. 27. We have had what we call vital, which means sustaining of life, spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangement. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding force of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. I read this book over and over and over, and it was quite clear, fast and in a hurry, that this damn thing was not about drinking. That I had to change who I was to the core. Alcoholism does not come in bottles. It comes in people. And I read this book like a mad dog, like my life depended on it. Because it did. Until this day, 2 years sober, it still does. I have to be actively working these 12 steps, be in this program of recovery as outlined in the book. I have to be engaged with it still to this day. But anyways, I got in the book. I started reading it. I did everything that they suggested at this place. I realized that my way of living did not work. My ideas got me into a 35-day treatment facility. That's what my thinking and my way of doing things did. So I said, you know what? I am not capable of making any of my decisions. I'm going to do exactly what they tell me to do. I did what the lady at the hospital told me to do. It's working out. I'm going to do what they tell me to do. So they started talking to me about aftercare, sober living programs. Sober living? To some of y'all, maybe been in and out and been around this for years. I had not been around this. I didn't know what they were talking about. But you know what? They told me to do it, so I was going to do it. I stayed in this work. And honestly, looking back, even though my first sponsor took me through the work again, I can look back and know that I genuinely had a step 1, 2, and 3 experience. I remember getting down on my knees at Blue Ridge, this little carriage house that the guys over 30-something get to stay in, thank God, because I didn't have 8 roommates, I only had one. And I put the physical ailments on a little extra. I can't handle them stairs. I need to go out there to that one roommate in a private shower. I need to do that, so I did that. But it was a good thing that I had that private room, because at night I didn't have the distractions, or private, semi-private room. I laid in that book every night, and my roommate was, early stage dementia, and he was a damn hoot. Every night he would come in and I'd be reading a book, and he said, man, you sure do like that book. Do you think you're going to finish that book before you get out of here? Hey, if you need anything, I got snacks and bananas and PB&Js I stashed behind the basket over here. I heard those same exact words for like 2 or 3 weeks before, till he left. But every night I'd go to bed when it was bedtime. I followed the rules and I read this book. And one day I got to this point in here where it said, this is the how and the why of it, basically saying how it works and why it works. It said, first of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are His agents. He is the Father. We are His children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone to the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. He provided what we needed if we kept close to Him and performed His work well. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life as we felt new power flow in. As we enjoyed peace of mind, we discovered we could face life successfully. I got down on my knees. And there's not a doubt, 2 years later, I meant every word that I said. See, because I had, when I read, man, I got to page 62, and that was a whopper. If you want to look, I've only had this book for a couple of months, but 62, you can see I got a lot going on right here. We could probably spend a better part of the night talking about that one page. I would find it exciting, but probably most of you would not. So, most. There's some exceptions. But on page 62, it tells me this, and I am jumping around a little bit, but right before I got down on my knees, I read this. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. I ain't do nothing. But through, and it was really pointed out when I did an inventory with my sponsor that we invariably find that at some time in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. I'm full of self. Loved it. Self-delusion, self-pity, self-seeking, self-centered. Self-centered. There were times where I thought too highly of myself. There were times where I thought too little of myself. But the biggest thing was I thought too damn often of myself. Constantly. What can I get? How can I get mine? How can you improve my situation? Really, I mean, I love my family and my friends. I loved them, you know, but what can I get out of it? Whether it just be joy and validation. But I've got to get something out of it. That it told me what, you know, so my troubles, I think, are basically of my own making. They arise out of myself. And I'm an extreme example of alcohol, an extreme example of self-will run riot. Above everything, I must be rid of selfishness. I must, or it will kill me. But then there's something beautiful, right? Four words right after that. God makes that possible. And my chief responsibility today is I got it right here in case I like to trip over my words, especially when I'm nervous and there's a gazillion people staring at me. I have a sticker in front of my book and it's real important. As soon as I open my book, I see it every day when I open it. Our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate presentation of the program. And so an adequate presentation is, I happen to be a Christian. I don't care what your faith is. I don't care what your idea of God is. When I work with a newcomer, I want them, my job is to not convert them, is to wake them up. Is to hopefully assist them through these 12 steps to where they can get to a point to where they tap into a power greater than themselves. I don't care what you call it. I said, I'm not here to convert you. I've worked with so many people, there's a lot in the room right now, but it never once have I said, hey, you want to go to church with me on Sunday? Not that there's anything wrong with that, but when I get here in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that is not my primary concern. My concern is you recover from this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body is what my concern is. I want you to have an experience with this power and tap into it so you can an experience sufficient to recover from alcoholism. So when I say God here, talking about the God you understand God, the way you understand it. But this thing hit me like a ton of bricks. God makes this possible. I knew what was going on in me. I knew that I was the problem. I read this. I need to quit playing God. Okay, hell yeah, it's time for me to hit my knees in front of this window. God, I give you my will and my life. My thoughts and my actions take it all because I suck at the job of running the show. I suck at this. I cannot do it. And I did it. And I was excited. I was excited to get out, and I was terrified to get out of treatment. Because at this time, I had a real desire to not drink anymore. But I was still had an obsession to drink. I didn't know how to not drink. I remember crying the night before I left treatment. I said, I don't want to drink. I want to have this life. I believe y'all are telling me the truth, and I want it. And I can tell something's changing in me, but there's a store 2 miles down the road, and I am terrified what I do when I get out of here. And they looked at me and said, you know, they smiled. And I'm like, what the hell are you smiling about? Said, because we're not worried. Because it's the men and women with your attitude that we don't see come back. He said, if you acted like you had this thing and there was no doubt, we would be worried. You have a level of honesty. See, I didn't know. I knew I didn't want to drink, but I didn't know how not to. On page 24, it says, at a certain point, the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. The fact is, the most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost power and choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times, not saying all the time, maybe just at some certain time. Maybe you can tough it out now and then. We're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. What this book is telling me is that if I'm truly alcoholic, there's quite a few people in here tonight. There is a chance that some of you are not. There is a chance that some of you can get a talking to from your judge or your old lady, and you'll put it down. I am not that person. I am an alcoholic. I drink no matter what. Without this program of action, without taking these steps, I am going to drink. And if I drink, I am going to die if I am lucky. Because I am a real alcoholic. When I first got here, people said, I'm a real alcoholic. I'm like, what the hell? Am I a fake one? I didn't understand. I didn't understand. What they're talking about is there's certain people who can come in this room and stay sober for years and years and years on the fellowship alone and that good talking to from the judge. Judge looks at two people. Here's a good example. Judge looks at two guys. Two guys standing to each other, got in trouble, whatever. It says, look, if either one of you boys drink again, you're going to do 60 days in jail. I'm telling you right now, not one drop. We're going to check you. We're going to put a bracelet on you. This is the way it's going to go down. One of them's a hard drinker. One of them's an alcoholic. Hard drinker's like, whew, man, I know I'm not going to go to the liquor store. I'm standing there and I'm like, damn, I wonder what jail's going to be like. Because I know there is no chance that by the time I leave that courtroom, I am drinking. That is what a real alcoholic is. For anybody who's wondering. So anyways, get out of treatment. They take me to sober living. They bring me right up here the first night to the Howe place. And I love telling the story. I come up to the Howe place. I'm about 47. I got to stay some extra days at Blue Ridge because I was extra sick. So 47 days I come up here sober. 47 days. I am not a social butterfly. I am still very much obsessed with the drink. I tell the people watching me at Sober Living, they stopped at a convenience store. They say, hey, man, go and get you some cigarettes. I'm like, you coming in? And they're like, no, man, you cool? And I said, no, I'm not cool. I said, either you're going to come in or I'm going to drink. I was brutally honest with them. I said, you cannot take your eyes off of me. I will drink. There's somebody in the room right now. It's kind of funny. Just made me think about it. He said, I look like walking death at 47 days sober. He's like, damn, this dude don't look good. Just made me think of it, bud. But I was standing out front talking to a couple of people. There were people come up. The hand of AA was there. They seen that I was new. I probably got approached by 6 or 8 people, and that's how it's supposed to go down. I've mentioned to the guys that I work with lots of times that, anyways, we'll have a conversation if there's a newcomer and I don't see you shaking his hand and talk to him, because that's what our primary purpose is. But anyways, this guy walked up to me and, I'm sorry, I got to shout your name out, brother. I can't help it. But he walks up to me and he says, hey, man, my name's Stefan. I'm your sponsor. Like some kind of surfer boy or something. I'm like, what the hell? He's like 20-something years old, and I'm thinking, great. He's 20. I'm almost 40. Yeah, this is going to work out. But you know what? He had something that I didn't have. He didn't have years of life lessons, but he had 9 years of sobriety and working a program to share with me. And boy, did we jump in. I guess he wanted to test my willingness and see if I was full of BS or not. And he hit me and said, well, I'll tell you what to do. Go home tonight and write down 1,000 things you're grateful for. And I'll say, I don't know. It's a treatment thing. It's not in the book. But you know what? I was excited to do it. It kept my mind off thinking about drinking that night. That's the one thing that it did. Maybe he knew that. So I wrote those 1,000 things. We talked. He gave me some step work, some things to do, some things to read. I did it. We sat down, we formally did a third step again. And he gave me a fourth step and explained what I was supposed to do. He said, 2 weeks we're going to meet up and we're going to go over this. I slept very little for the next 72 hours. I wrote straight and I called him up and he could tell by the sound of my voice that we needed to meet right then. At once. We vigorously commenced. And when this thing was wrote, we wasted no time sharing it. And something happened. It wasn't a white light. It wasn't a burning bush. But something happened. And he said, I want you to go outside, walk around for a little while. Just spend time with God. I want you to think about what we've done here. And I didn't realize we were following instructions, but we were. And I didn't mark it, so I'm going to get over here to it. He basically said, I want you to carefully review what we just did in these first 5 proposals. Spend this time with God and think about it. And I answered to my satisfaction that I had taken those 5 steps. And to his. So then we looked at step 6. We looked at it. Is there anything that God, that I'm not, that is there anything? I'll just read the damn thing. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God, not me, let God remove things, all things from us which we've admitted are objectionable? Can he take them all, every one? I didn't even have to pray for willingness. Hell yes, God, please take it. I don't have the power. I had a third step experience. I don't have the power. Yes, take them. I'm willing. Wait, and then it said, well, when ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. I got really confused. I was like, damn, I still have these defects of character. Well, looking back, rereading, I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows, is what it said. It didn't say nothing about everyone's going to be removed. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. You now completed step 7. And I've read this over and over, these 2 paragraphs, and don't say a damn word about me working on my defects of character.
And today I can tell you this, I found the best way to work 6 and 7 is to actively work a step 10 and 11. But anyways, I did this, and it said we needed more action. So let's look at 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we've harmed to whom we're willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. See, because when we're doing this, we're writing things down. I have these defects of character. We're identifying them when I'm getting down to causes and conditions and figuring out who I am. Figuring out all of these things. When I'm looking at this inventory, we're getting down, we're getting a couple things out of this. Well, we're getting a ton of things, but I don't have time to go into that. And oh God, the time. But I have this list of people that I've harmed. I did it when I took inventory. We have a list of all persons we've harmed and to whom we're willing to make amends. Step 8. Made a list of all persons we've harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I have a list of people I've harmed and whom I'm willing to make amends to. When did I become willing? Maybe somewhere between 3 and 7. We talked about my amends. We looked at what they were like. I made one without consulting him, and it went fantastic. I got on this high. I got on this high from making these amends to come people out there cleaning up the wreckage of my past. Hell yes, this feels good. I like it. It's like a high. Everybody's saying that I forgive you, and it feels good to clean all this mess up. And then when I say it got good to me, and I said, I'm just going to make this one on my own, and I'm not going to ask him. And I did, and it didn't go good. She said, you know, I just want to let you know that there's not a day gone by for the past 5 years that I haven't woke up hating you. She said, I blame you for everything that is wrong in my life. She used the F word a lot. And she basically said, I effing hate you. And I was like, wow, I thought this was going to be an easy one. Thought it was going to give me a couple I'm sorry's and make a new friend like the other ones went. This one didn't turn out that way. Today, we're fine. We can talk, have a conversation. She's forgiven me, whatnot. But that's not really the point. The point was for me to clean up my side of the street. But anyways, wow, time is flying by. I'm sorry. But anyways, the point being, from the time this young man stuck his hand out till the time he had me growing in understanding and effectiveness and doing upon awakening and when I retire at night, as sick and as cloudy as my head was after 20 years of drinking alcoholically, it wasn't 2 months I held my hand up for the first time in this room. I had something to transmit at that point. Something worthwhile to transmit. And I'll tell you right now, we all have something to transmit. It's what are we transmitting? Back to that adequate presentation of the program. Back to that. Anyways, I raised my hand. I got 2 sponsees the first day, and I have been a mad dog, and I have not stopped since. There's so much I wanted to say. Tom told me, my sponsor told me, there's always 3 stories. The one was the one you planned to say, the one you take?
You're going
to
say the one you said and the one you
wanted. Yeah, exactly. Honestly, I believe that whatever I'm supposed to say, whatever I say up here was what I was supposed to say. Because today I trust in a loving, all-powerful God, an infinite God. I trust in an infinite God rather than my finite self today. So, anyways, I worked these steps, all of these steps. When I got to a point to where I was continuing to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear on a regular basis, like it come to me like this, when I hit my knees in the morning upon awakening, I asked God to direct my thinking, and at night I constructively, not destructively, constructively reviewed my day, and my sponsor seen that I was doing these things. I said, go raise your hand, help somebody. Once again, he seen that I was doing these things. I had a message to carry. Real quick. I might run over a second. If I do, I'm sorry. Call your sponsor. Okay.
We alcoholics are undisciplined. So we let God discipline us in the simple way just outlined, talking about this is the end of into action. Not into thinking, into action. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. Anybody got any idea what the next chapter is called?
Working on yourself.
No, it's not that, buddy. It's working with others. So let me read that again. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. And I know there's other things in step 12. I read the book. But step 12, working with others. It don't say working on others. So did you work the 12 steps? Yeah, I worked the 12 steps. Didn't work for me. How many guys were you working with? Well, I never sponsored anybody. Okay, let's strike that one off. So how were you with prayer and meditation? I didn't really do that. Okay, let's knock off 11. How are you with the spot check inventory, step 10? On the spot inventory. I didn't really do that. So basically what you're telling me is that you relapsed because it didn't work, yet you didn't do none of the work. The reason I bring this up is I hear it all the time. I'm blessed to be able to work with people that I meet right outside here, and I go to treatment centers and I speak to people and I hear this. And not one time have I ever heard anyone say, man, I was taking guys through this precise method of recovery as the big book outlines from the blank page to 103, all 12 steps, and I did a spot check inventory religiously, and prayer and meditation was my favorite pastime, but you know what? I got drunk. I've never yet to hear that. Not one time. I'm going to read something real quick and I'm going to shut up. On page 153 in A Vision for You, I love this. I love this. This is my jam. It says, it may seem incredible that these men are to become happy, respected, and useful once more. How can they rise out of such misery, bad repute, and hopelessness? The practical answer is that since these things have happened among us, they can happen with you. Here comes the rub. Should you wish them above all else, and be willing to make use of our experience. We are sure they will come. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. When I read this in that treatment center, when I read this in Blue Ridge, it burned in deep. Thank God it burned in deep. I have to want it above everything else. I've got to be honest. I've got to get an open mind if I'm ever going to think about being willing. So I gotta have this want, but this want is not enough. Just stressing it. I had to put it. Job, no job. Wife, no wife. House, no house. Nothing. Anything I put ahead of recovery, I was not going to keep. And be willing to make use of our experience. These people that got together. These first 176, whatever you want to call it, the 400 some odd people that had review it that put all this together, whatever the numbers are. Anyways, there's a lot of people thought about it, this experience that went down. I got to make use of this experience, this precise method of recovery. Did anybody hear me say this yet? That it's a precise, clear-cut instructions, precise method of recovery? I cannot stress that enough. But not just their experience. When that girl shares that she had 20 months, and thought that she had it, that shit rung in deep. When that guy says that he was stealing from his home group at a couple of years, that shit rang in deep. When he says that I sit in this room for 7 years and was miserable, and all I was free, all I did was not drink, rang in. I made use of everybody's experience who came before me. I wanted it above all else. I made use of the experience. And I have not had to relapse. I'm not knocking anybody. I'm not judging anybody. If you relapse, it's part of your story. I'm not judging. Love you. But I know that there are some newcomers in here. I see quite a few tonight. Relapse is not part of recovery. It is part of the damn disease.
Amen.
I come in here, I picked up one white chip, and I got 2 years. My sponsor picked up a chip, and he's got 33 years. He's pretty sick, too.
33.
Was it 30? What did I say?
33.
Oh, okay, yeah, 33. Something. It was in the 30s, anyway. Anyways, it doesn't have... It's not part of recovery. Today, I can tell you this, I'm sure... Now, I've went over, so I'll end it up, but... Today I absolutely insist on enjoying life. Today I am sure that God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. I got to read this one thing. It's real quick. It's real quick. I'll hurry, Jane. Please don't slap me. I love Jane. She's scary though. Anyways, this book tells me a lot of things. It's an instruction manual. It tells me what my problem is. It tells me what the root of my problem is, the crux of my problem. It tells me what my real purpose is. It tells me what my job is. It tells me where and how to find God. It tells me so many things. But today where I'm at, this is where I'm at today, and I love every second of it. So I'm just going to read this couple of sentences on page 102 in the big book. In working with others, it says, your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life, and with these motives, keep on the firing line of life with these motives, and God will keep you unharmed. So what I'm going to do, what I'm going to continue to do, and I don't care if I stand alone or not, I'd rather not stand alone. But I have a message and I'm going to keep carrying it. It's in a precise method of recovery laid out in the first 164 pages of the big book with the support of an amazing fellowship that I can't begin to describe. Recovery, big book, unity, fellowship. Service, carrying this message, staying on the fire line. That's all I got. Thanks for letting me share.